Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice, fair use, successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com.
Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. Caitlin Boyle is our guest today. She's the founder of Film Sprout and a pioneer of grassroots distribution for independent films. She has served as the architect of national screening and audience outreach initiatives for dozens of award-winning feature documentaries, including King Korn and The End of the Line. And Carol, I know these are favorites of yours as well.
Yes, Claire, these are brilliant films and very well distributed. So thank you so much for coming, Caitlin.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, we really would like to start and learn more about your company, Film Sprout. So tell us why you started it.
Sure. I came from a background in production. I went to journalism school, and my first job out of grad school was at WNET, which is the PBS affiliate in New York City, where Film Sprout is based now. And I loved the production work. I loved the research. I loved the storytelling. I loved being behind the scenes and the excitement of, you know, watching the film air after so many, you know, weeks and months of work. But there was a missing link for me personally, which was the connection with the audience. You know, when you work for a broadcaster, you see something go out over the airwaves and you never really hear from the audience. You know, you never hear their applause. You don't hear their commentary. You don't see whether they're laughing or crying or whether they're moved. And while we often would hear from people after a show aired, and people would say that they had been moved or that they wanted to help, or that they, you know, were interested in learning more about the topic after seeing the film, we didn't really have a clear infrastructure for connecting them to the story in any kind of, you know, direct way. And so after I left WNET and was working for a couple of independent filmmakers who were working outside of the broadcast system to produce their films, I realized there was this opportunity to connect with audiences a little bit more directly. And one of the projects that I was working on in a research capacity began to have, you know, traditional theatrical distribution, and people started coming out of the woodwork to ask about the film and how they could help and how they could see it and how they could bring it to their town. And it was at that moment that I really pivoted from a production role to a distribution role, and I realized there was this kind of sweet spot, especially for documentaries, where you can really actually engage audiences pretty directly once a film has been released and work with them pretty comprehensively to get that story in places, to places it might not otherwise go, and to inspire action that might not otherwise happen. So that was really the genesis. And after working on a couple of projects on a freelancer basis and understanding where the niche was for grassroots distribution, I decided why not start a company and serve more filmmakers in a really organized and accessible way. And so Film Sprout was born.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, with the films that you're handling now, these the most important and gigantic films, I guess, that you've done very well. And I noticed on your website that you are not taking any more films to distribute in 2014. So why is that, Caitlin?
Well, I wish we could. We are a small boutique operation. We are a staff of 2 to 4, sometimes 5, depending on the projects we're working on. And we want to stay small. We want to be able to focus really diligently and with a really single-minded approach on the films that we are developing outreach campaigns for and distribution campaigns for. So we usually work on just two or three films each year. And this year, we ended up just getting booked fairly far in advance. I know it's only May, and it's actually unusual for us to not be able to take on more films at this point in the year, but that's where we ended up. In a way, it's a lucky place to be because we know that, you know, the projects that we're going to work on for the rest of the year, but it also means that, you know, there's you know, a number of exciting and interesting films that we can't work on in a full-scale capacity in 2014. So, you know, we're looking ahead to, toward 2015 already.
So you're booking for 2015?
We're booking films for 2015, certainly, and we're looking for new titles to take on in 2015, which actually, you know, at this point of the year, many films that are currently on the festival circuit, they won't really be ready to distribute until early in 2015 anyway. So yes, we are looking ahead to 2015 to see what other projects who are seeking, you know, a full-scale community screenings or grassroots distribution campaign that we can lend our efforts to. Our eyes are open right now.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, can you tell us who you are handling this year?
Yes, I would love to. Right now we're working on an amazing campaign for a film called Damnation, and it's an environmental documentary that's about dam removal, the movement for dam removal primarily in the American West, although across the country as well. It's a film that was made by a few independent filmmakers, and it has been sponsored and is currently being distributed by Patagonia, the outdoor clothing company. It's just been released. It actually opens in New York City theatrically on Friday, so New Yorkers can come see it on the big screen. But we are coordinating a nationwide screenings tour of the film among grassroots communities. So, you know, the theatrical release really will bring the film to several major markets and theaters. Patagonia will bring the film to another couple dozen markets where they have retail locations, and they'll do some really fun in-store screenings, which is kind of a unique distribution strategy for a documentary. And then we are spearheading the grassroots efforts. So we're working with dozens of organizations across the country who are hosting screenings at their nonprofits or as fundraisers or at government agencies, in schools, on college campuses, as part of trade shows and rallies, and even some small businesses, people who do work on rivers, you know, like canoe outfitters, kayak outfitters, river runners, they're screening the film as well. So we're in the midst of that. It's a new campaign for us, and we will run that campaign through the fall.
Wow, what an interesting concept for distribution. So now will the filmmaker, there's so many questions here. Will the filmmaker be at some of these outreach places? And will they make money is the key.
Great question. I'm glad you asked. The answer to both is yes. In the particular case of Damnation, there are three filmmakers, and they all two live in Colorado and one lives in Southern California, and they will travel with the film. You know, they've been traveling with the theatrical release, and then they will continue to travel at some of these grassroots screenings. And I'm glad you brought up the money piece of things, because one of the things that makes Film Sprout different and sort of distinguishes our approach from that of other outfits and other distributors is that we're really working to earn revenue for the films as we promote them. So these grassroots community screening tours are intended to do a number of things, one of which, of course, is to expand the visibility of the film and the audience for the film. Another is to put the issue on the table and to provide a tool and a resource for organizations, in this case, who are working on dam removal initiatives, to, you know, rally around a film screening, which obviously provides a beautiful and thought-provoking piece of media to, you know, stage a discussion around and to stage social action around. But then lastly, but certainly not least, is the imperative that this campaign also earns money. And the mechanism allows that is licensing fees from the community organizations who are showing the film. We offer those on a sliding scale. And organizations who are interested in showing the film, let's say at a church or at a school or at a university campus or at their nonprofit, they contact us. They pay a licensing fee for the rights to screen that film. And then they're really free to shape the event in pretty much any way they want. They're allowed to raise money at the screening. They're allowed to collect admission. They're allowed to use the film to spark some kind of local action. But it also becomes, you know, they are actively supporting the distribution of the film as well through their licensing payment. So it's a great win for both parties, for the exhibitor, you know, the nonprofit, let's say, who's screening the film, but then also for the filmmaker who's earning, you know, a small amount of money from each screening. But when you multiply that by 30 screenings, 50 screenings, 100 screenings, 300 screenings, that you know, that money adds up, and essentially it funds the outreach campaign, and then ideally it also generates profit on top of the campaign itself. So it's a unique model. It's sort of a crowdfunding model, crowdsourced distribution in some ways. And it also really enables us to put the film in places where it would never otherwise go in commercial settings. You know, we might not otherwise be in Spokane, Washington, because it's not a major media market, but we can go there because we've got grassroots support on the ground. So it really is intended to be distribution and at the same time community engagement.
Okay, well, when you say we have grassroots support, did the filmmaker find these places or did you?
You know, it's a mix, and in the best cases, it's a collaborative effort. So in the case of Damnation, a lot of the credit goes to the filmmakers and to Patagonia, who is distributing the film, because they have had longstanding relationships with many of the advocates who are working on dam removal issues, particularly around watersheds in the American West. And those relationships have been cultivated, in the case of Patagonia, over decades. In the case of the film, over the, you know, the last few years of the film's, you know, production schedule. So in part, and this is true not only of Damnation but also of the other films we represent, in part we are leveraging the relationships that the filmmaker or the production company has begun to make. You know, every filmmaker begins to forge those relationships as they're making the film. They interview experts, and they get location releases, and they talk with stakeholders, and they research who the advocates are and who the players are in the issues that they're spotlighting. And those relationships can grow and blossom into distribution relationships in many cases. So for sure, filmmakers often are kind of seeding those relationships way before we are on the scene. But what we hope to do, and why I think we can be a valuable resource to filmmakers, is really round out those relationships and bring new ones into the mix. Having represented, I think now about more than 12 campaigns, I think Damnation is maybe our 13th or 14th campaign that we've run over the last 5 years. And, you know, as we release each film across the country and sometimes across the world, we are, of course, generating our own contacts. And we are learning, you know, who are the environmental advocates in Oregon? Who are the student activists in the Northeast? Who are the people who really care about oceans and water issues in the Midwest? You know, we're generating all of these relationships as well. And so the idea is that we are bringing to bear some of the work, the groundwork that we have built over the last several years to each of the campaigns that we're working on. And then the third arm is really new research. You know, we want to make the most of the relationship the filmmaker brings and the relationships we already have, but then we also want to be very proactive. And I think that's where we have a unique approach to distribution in many ways, because we're not just relying on existing networks. We're really trying to push the boundaries of where a film might otherwise go. So in the case of Damnation, you know, just to give a very specific example, we have represented environmental films in the past. So we have many contacts across the country who we know are interested in environmental issues and topics and use films as a way to educate their communities and spark local action. But we also knew in the case of Damnation that the social action campaign around that film is to really remove the big dams that are currently basically blocking the Snake River watershed. And so we wanted to make sure we were really saturating that particular geographical area. And so we have done a lot of proactive outreach to reach organizations that are based in that part of the country and to really facilitate their participation in the campaign. So it's a mix, and I think it should be a mix if you want a robust campaign.
Well, you certainly have a good foundation for other environmental films to come work with you.
Mm-hmm. I hope
right.
so.
Well, does Patagonia distribute many films? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting new chapter for them in many ways. The film's genesis in part came from Patagonia, the seed of the idea, and they contacted a couple of independent filmmakers who had a history of making environmental films. And Travis Rummel and Ben Knight and Matt Steckler is the third filmmaker. And so it was really a collaboration from the beginning. So it's an exciting model because a company like Patagonia really does have, what people often call the double bottom line. Of course, they're a for-profit company and they sell things as corporations do, as companies do, but they're also really interested in environmental sustainability, and they have longstanding relationships with environmental advocates working at the local level. They have a grant-making program that supports local environmental organizations, and their business practices are very much underpinned by sustainability, principles of sustainability. So this is a really interesting new avenue for us to work directly with a company who's not a film company, and they are bringing to bear some of the resources that they have as a retailer. As I mentioned, the film's exhibition strategy is going to include a couple of dozen in-store screenings that are going to take place in June, just a few weeks from now, in some of the Patagonia stores across the country. And that's a network that a traditional documentary distributor doesn't typically have, So there, it's a bit of a brave new world for us both. But so far, it's been really invigorating to see what's possible when you kind of push the boundaries of what has been done before in film distribution.
Absolutely. Well, so this is actually a new model where a distributor finds filmmakers.
Yes.
Fantastic, because there was a specific film they wanted made, and they do give grants to other filmmakers who are making sustainable films.
That's
on
right.
The environment.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So I think it's been a natural outgrowth of the work that Patagonia was already doing, but it certainly is a new model and very interesting to see how the storytelling has remained very independent. It's not a corporate piece. It's not an advertisement. It is really, it's a standalone narrative. Two of the filmmakers appear in the film. One of the filmmakers narrates the film. So it really does have the feel of an indie film. And I encourage you guys to see it because it has a real soul to it, which you might not expect from a film that is collaborating with a for-profit, but it really does. And that's why it was appealing to us, because it still has the integrity of an independent story.
Wonderful. Well, I know you do consultations, so let's talk about some of the things that you do. If someone comes to you to hire you to learn more about marketing in today's world, what are some of the first things you do, Caitlin?
Well, one of the first conversations we often have when we're working with filmmakers in a consultation setting is a talk about goals, a very frank, honest, no holds barred talk about goals, because that's often the starting place that you no need to have if you're anticipating running a grassroots and community screening campaign and distributing your film through grassroots networks in the way that we do. And typically when we're consulting with filmmakers, we're consulting with them because they want to run their own campaigns in-house. They've made a film. The film has typically just been finished. Maybe it's started on the festival circuit. And they're noticing that their film really has grassroots appeal that is, you know, demand that is coming from non-traditional networks. So demand that's coming from beyond broadcast or beyond VOD or beyond theatrical distribution. Hearing from educators, hearing from activists, hearing from advocates on a particular issue, hearing from stakeholders on a particular issue. And one of the first conversations that we really have to answer is, what do you want to do with your film? How do you want it to change the conversation about your issue? How do you want it to inspire people? When the lights come up after a screening of your film, what is it that you want to leave your audience with? What do you want people to do? How do you want to rally and inspire them? And often in the, you know, in the throes of editing, in the dark editing room, in the months and sometimes years on end that it takes to make an independent film, those questions are not always at the forefront. Of course, you know, producers, directors are asking questions about how do I want the film to make people feel and what experience do I want them to have when they see it and what do I want them to learn. But the next set of questions about where, you know, if nowhere else, where do I want this film to be seen and by whom, those questions are not always answered right away. And so we kind of dive into that as early as possible so that we can start to identify some of the strategic choices that we might make. You know, you mentioned King Korn, for example. That was the first film that we created a campaign for back in 2007. And, you know, the film is about farm subsidies and corn farming. Major commodity corn farming, and you know it's old enough now that I can say with, you know, 7 years of perspective that, you know, we could have dug even deeper into what the goals were. But that said, at the time we were really interested in figuring out how we could reach farm communities. How could we reach the communities where commodity farming, you know, conventional farming of the major commodity crops, wheat and rice and soy and corn, were grown, and how could we change the conversation about government farm subsidies in those places so that the film did not just galvanize people on the coasts, you know, urbanites who might be interested in the issue from kind of a consumer position, but how could we really galvanize people, you know, mostly in the Midwest where most of these crops are grown, particularly corn and soy. And so we had to ask some really tough questions about, you know, where do we want the film to be seen? And should it only be in theaters, or should we bring it to farms? Should we bring it to, you know, ag schools? Should we bring it to the conventional farming conventions and conferences? So we're not just kind of, you know, showing the film to an urbane audience that actually is not living and breathing the issues of the film every day. So that was a very deliberate, strategic choice that we made and then could respond to and could carve a strategy around. And the outgrowth of it ended up being that we created an Iowa tour of the film in December 2007, a couple of months after the film's theatrical release. We decided, let's bring the film to Iowa. Let's bring it to the communities in Iowa where we can have this really substantive, nuanced conversation about what it means to be a corn farmer or a soy farmer, soybean farmer in today's agricultural climate. And so we brought the film to an old historic opera house in Sioux Falls, and we brought the film to, in one instance, we brought it to a little mini theater that was that doubled as an indoor mini golf course in a small town in Iowa. So we were really creative in figuring out, you know, if there's not an art house theater there, how can we still have this kind of cinematic experience that also inspires the kinds of conversation the film was created to inspire? So, you know, that's one of the things that we are often really fixated on is, you know, this question of goals.
How fantastic. And then you carry it all the way through. I'm sure the filmmakers keep readjusting their goals as their vision broadens, right?
That's true. And I think that's actually a key component of brainstorming and strategizing for grassroots and community screening campaigns. You have to have two minds. You have to be of two minds. You have to have a somewhat rigid and well-thought-out, well-researched, stable plan, strategy, something, you know, a rubric that you're working with so that you can fundraise, so that you can create a budget, so that you can create an outreach plan and a marketing plan. You've got to have, you have got to have a plan. You've got to stick to it. But at the same time, you have to allow yourself to be flexible and adaptable because things change. You know, legislation passes or doesn't pass. You know, a hurricane hits or doesn't hit. Something major changes in the life of the story. We consulted on a film a couple of years ago that was about medical marijuana legislation in Montana, a film called Code of the West, by a filmmaker named Rebecca Richmond Cohen. And she had made this beautiful film that really focused on this question of medical marijuana, what happens when a state has legalized medical marijuana, at least in certain ways, under certain parameters, but it is still, of course, illegal from a federal perspective. The film really dove deep into this question of kind of the state laws versus the federal laws, and it was this beautiful character-driven story. Well, the film locked. The film premiered at a film festival. It had other festival screenings. A community screenings campaign was begun. It focused specifically on Montana, but also on other states that where the issue of legalized medical marijuana was kind of at a tipping point. Either legislation was about to be passed or a referendum was up for a vote, et cetera. And then one of the characters of the film was arrested. And not only arrested, but then as the months went on, he was sentenced. And the film was locked, but the story was continuing. And this is real life, right? Documentaries are real life, so they're messy, and they are complicated, and life goes on after the film is finished and the credits roll. So Rebecca did this amazing thing, which I think is the pinnacle of adaptability and flexibility. She opened up the film again, and she incorporated this news about the sentencing, which I won't ruin for those of you who have not seen the film. I won't say what happens, but it was a really pivotal moment, and it added a great deal of gravitas and charge, you know, emotional charge to the film. And it was very brave for her to do that, you know, to take something that is at first face locked and done and already in the public eye, and to create a new ending with the information that you have. So that is a case in point of the need to be as adaptable as you can be. It doesn't always mean changing your film, of course. Actually, it rarely means changing your film. But it does mean realizing when opportunities are shifting or arising, and being able to be opportunistic in that way, and to shift your strategy as life changes.
Very smart of her. I like that. Well, I know from teaching that when you start talking to filmmakers who maybe have been on their film for a year, year and a half, and they are very interested in raising money, and they're looking to, or they're in pre-production or just starting to take interviews, and you say, well, who's your audience? Oh, well, everybody. Well, you know, women are going to want this film. Wait a minute. When you say, well, we have to find out, we have to get specific. What are your key words? They don't even know what that means, and they don't want to know. And how does your audience find news? I mean, what is the way you can reach your audience? First, who is it, and how do you reach them? And they don't like to hear that. I always feel, thank God I'm on a phone, because if I was standing on a stage, I know the tomatoes would be flying towards me.
it's very hard
to get into the mindset that they need to know that, one, knowing who their market is from an early stage allows them to collect names on their website. And so do most of the films come to you with a decent database or not? And if not, well, how do you get them into that mindset, Caitlin?
It's an excellent question. It's one of the most crucial questions. I think you have to know your goals and you have to know who your audience is. And if you have done both, then you are really teed up for a successful campaign. And if you haven't, then you have a lot of work cut out for you. I would say that the filmmakers who are consulting with us are often at the beginning of that journey. You know, maybe they've just locked their film or they're in a rough cut stage. They're beginning to apply to festivals and they're beginning to think really hard about who their audiences are and how to reach them. So our consulting clients are very much coming to us with small databases by and large. There are some exceptions to that, of course. And one of our primary goals in the consultative setting is to help them build a robust database and really not just to find their audience, but to recognize their audience when it's right in front of them. I think that's one of the hardest things to do. As you say, a lot of filmmakers, when I first ask them to identify who their audiences are, they end up identifying fairly broad swaths of the population. They'll say women between 18 and 30, or they'll say college students, or they'll say fathers, or they'll say environmentalists, or they'll say civil libertarians. You know, it's not a specific picture at all that we get when we hear those words. And I actually encourage filmmakers to think about particular people. You know, there's kind of the truism of writing that, you know, sometimes you can create the best story if you write for one person in particular. Some writers say, you know, I write for my sister, I write for my best friend. And I think that you have to kind of get on that same wavelength when you're a filmmaker thinking about who your audience is. You have to think really specifically, you know, it's not just fathers. Maybe it's fathers who live in, you know, the Pacific Northwest, who have kids under the age of 12, who are very invested in education issues, who are, you know, in professional trades, who are not typical moviegoers, but who will be really rallied by the story of children who are experiencing social rejection at school. You know, it's that specific, in other words. You have to really drill down to who exactly is going to show up at a screening, who would host a screening. I think one of the things that gets lost sometimes in this conversation about who your audience is an understanding of the work it takes to be an audience member. We think of it as a passive activity. We think of it being about showing up, you know, someone just showing up and the word butts in seats is often, you know, used to describe the goal of packing a house or filling a theater. But that act is actually really proactive on the part of the audience. They have to leave their normal life. They've got to get a babysitter. They've got to buy a ticket. Maybe they have to do it online. They've got to drive somewhere. They've got to show up and be engaged and put the rest of their life on hold for 90 minutes. And that's hard. And so we have to think about who is motivated enough to do that. Who in our audience is going to set their life on hold for those 90 minutes and enter this neutral space, this dark room, and really engage. And once you begin to honor the audience in that way and really understand what it will take for them to be there, to get their butt in that seat, I think you can then be more specific about who your audience really is, because it's probably not going to be all fathers. You know, it's going to be a really specific subset. I also think that it's important to be really honest with yourself about who is at the very core of your audience and then who is more on the fringes. In other words, who's already right there with you? Who are the people for whom your story is evident, you know, it's resonant already, it is convincing already. You don't even need to give them the full synopsis and they get it. You know, who are the people for whom the log line is enough? They're at your very core. And that's a relatively small number of people, but they're a powerful subset of your audience. Those are the people who can take your audience from the choir to the congregation and then beyond the congregation. Thinking about Damnation, for example, you know, there are many activists water advocates who have been working on the issues of dam removal for a long, long time, decades. They know the issues inside out. They are extremely dedicated and committed. And you say the words dam removal, or you say the word Snake River, or you say the word Columbia River Basin, and they just know. Like, they know. They are right there. You don't have to describe anything further. They're going to come out and see this film because it is the lifeblood of the work that they are doing as advocates or as organizers. But if you move a step beyond that, or a few steps beyond that, and you just think of people who have gone on a river rafting trip, well, they're also in your audience, and they're also an important group to think about and to reach out to and to cultivate, but they might need a little bit more context. They might need a little bit more convincing. You might need to kind of connect the dots a little bit more for them to say, you know, those beautiful wild river passages that you ran down with your family on vacation, well, they're imperiled by some of these decades-old dams that are making it impossible for the wild rivers to run free in certain watersheds. Connecting those dots will make the difference between having them be your audience and be outside your audience. And so it will take a little bit more work to get them there. And that's the kind of rigorous thinking, specific, rigorous, tactical thinking that you need to do as a filmmaker as you're bringing your film into public life, whether that's through grassroots distribution or broadcast or a cinema release. Those are the kinds of questions you need to really be digging deep into.
Absolutely. But prior to that, you need to be never miss the opportunity. Anytime you're talking about your film, you're gathering emails of potential investors, donors, people who buy your tape, because they'll help you make the tape, Caitlin. These people will make the film. I believe that they will donate to you to help you make the film, and then they will be there to buy the DVD or pay for the download.
Absolutely, and you're right. You have to be cultivating these names and these relationships all the way through. One of the tools of the trade is the trusty clipboard and pen, and it's often underutilized. I think that technology has enabled us to be so much more sophisticated in terms of communicating with audiences and forging relationships and keeping those relationships fresh. And some of the tools that are out there, often they are app-based, phone-based, they're sometimes web-based. They're fantastic. But the trusty clipboard and the in-person, the handshake, the exchange of the business card, those things are still really important. And all the way through the life of the film, from pre-production, through production, through post-production, through the festival circuit, through those early days when you're making so many decisions as a filmmaker about where your film is going to have its public life and how the next several years of your film's release is going to play out, you're so busy and you think, I don't need to bring the clipboard, but you do. You need to bring the clipboard. You need to collect the names. And that really makes the difference. And, we have some clients who come to us off the festival circuit. Maybe they've had 4, 5, 6, festival screenings, not a huge number, but they come to us and they already have hundreds of names in their database. And that's usually because every time they met someone, every time they gave their elevator pitch to someone from development phase all the way through their festival phase, they were collecting business cards and they were collecting names and they were forging those relationships and keeping them fresh, following up, saying thanks, for your contribution, thanks for your time, nice to meet you, keeping those relationships alive. And those filmmakers who are very proactive, they are very easy to provide advice to and guidance to because they already have this basic set of tools. And then all we have to do is leverage them. All we have to do is set those tools in motion. It's a little bit harder when you're starting from scratch, but it can still be done. It really is never too late to start this process, even though the sooner the better is, of course, the watchword. The key takeaway is, start this early and often and keep it going through the whole life of your film. But a filmmaker who has gotten to their festival premiere and hasn't collected a single name should not feel that it's too late for them. there is still an audience out there waiting for the film. You just have to now hustle a little bit more to build that database now that your film is done. And you're right to speak to your point about crowdfunding. I think you're right. I think that true to the point of honoring your audience, I think there are audiences for every film who are supportive all the way through. They are willing to donate $50 or $100 or $500 to help get the film made. To help secure archival rights, to help do a sound mix, to help do, you know, a DCP. All the way through the filmmaking process, there are people who are willing to contribute, you know, relatively small amounts of money to make that happen. And then those contributors often become the super fans that you can rely on later to bring the film out into the public world, because they are invested in the very literal sense of the word. They have invested in you. They have put their money where their mouth is, and they want to see the film succeed. You know, too often I see filmmakers actually shy away from going back to audiences that have been supportive because they're afraid of wearing out their welcome. You know, they're afraid of sort of going back to the well again and again, and certainly that's something to be sensitive to, and there are some donors for whom their contribution is going to be a one-time thing. But there is always on every film a subset of an audience who really wants to help, and other people have said this, this is not my original thought, but the concept of independent film is really, of course, a misnomer, because it is dependent film. You are dependent on others to make it happen. I think Ashley Sabin is one of the filmmakers who I've heard say that, and it's really a nod to the reality, which is your audience is right there with you, funding the film, distributing the film, consuming the film, being a publicity arm for the film, and you have to cultivate that and respect it and show your gratitude for that all the way through the process.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. Well, what I find is that those people who have better databases, and I'm recommending everybody put on the zip code. You need the name, the email address, and the zip code. Why? Because at the end of the line, you want to consider using theatrical on demand. And when you have zip codes, you can say to Tug or Gather, I'm sitting on 2,000 people in the LA area, so I could do a great screening there, or I have 1,500 people in New York, right in Manhattan, Midtown. When you can walk in with those kind of numbers and that type of information, you are much further ahead than the other filmmakers, don't you think?
I agree. I think it's very critical to collect as much information as you can about your audience. And I think that zip codes, of course, email addresses and names and cities and towns, zip codes allow you to be a little bit more precise. It's also, you know, just from a technical standpoint, the zip code is often the piece of information that, you know, the back end of some of these systems need in order to process their data. So Tug and Gather and other, you know, CMS systems, they are reliant on, you know, somewhat codified ways of parsing information in order to generate more data and to make that data useful. So I think you're absolutely right. The zip code is key. And we find that it's not only useful for, you know, Tug and Gather and other sort of demand it tools that are out there. It's also useful for messaging. It's useful for social action as well. You know, let's say you have a film that is really instructive about a particular piece of legislation. Well, if you have zip code information, or at the very least, if you have city and state information, well, then you can then use the tools that are out there that can connect audiences with their members of Congress. For example, you know, you can identify, okay, which districts are we in and which Congress people are supporting the legislation and where are their home districts and where do we have an audience that matches up with those, with that representation. So that's an incredibly powerful tool that I think has been used you know, I know has been used for decades now by political campaigns, but hasn't been really used to its full capacity by filmmakers, certainly. And so, you know, that's another thing to keep in mind. There are applications beyond the film world for that kind of information. You can never really collect too much information, honestly, about your audiences. The more the better, and if you don't end up using it, then that's fine. But it's hard to collect that information, you know, retroactively.
Absolutely. Well, what do you think of the theatrical on demand?
I do like them. I think they're a really interesting addition to the distribution landscape. I think that particularly for films that are not going to have a traditional theatrical release or whose theatrical releases are relatively small, which is true of most independent films and certainly independent documentaries, even if you have what's considered comparatively a robust theatrical release, you're likely to be in, you know, 20 markets, 40 markets, maybe 100 markets at the very top, you know, and there are some exceptions to that, but not many. And so having a way to get your film in other cinema spaces is really interesting. I think the other piece of the TUG model, for example, that is really innovative is this idea that there's no financial bar to entry. You know, so someone who is interested in hosting a screening of a film, they can, for no money up front, begin to rally an audience around that. And because TUG has this, you know, tipping point model, once you reach this threshold, and enough tickets have been sold, then everybody wins. You know, the filmmaker earns some money, the theater earns some money, and the promoter on the ground earns some money. But you don't have to, you know, put any money down. You don't have to make an initial investment. And for some audiences, that's really crucial. We were working with a filmmaker earlier this week, the director of a film called Kidian's Army, and it's about public defenders. It's a really beautiful, moving film about the work that public defenders do. And she was telling us about an arm of their distribution strategy, which was executed through TUG, because public defenders, not only are they underpaid, and not only are public defender offices under-resourced, you know, basically nationwide, you know, it's a sector that is not, you know, by extension going to have the money to pay for a licensing fee up front, perhaps. And so they used TUG to organize screenings that were specifically for public defenders and around public defender offices. So there are certain applications of those tools, like TUG and Gather, that are extremely apt for particular films.
Sounds great to me. Well, another area that I find is that filmmakers normally under budget, seriously under budget, marketing and outreach. And I think those should be probably two line items. So, but give us your take. What do you think?
I agree. I think that part of the problem is that it costs so darn much just to make the film in the first place, and that ends up being the first priority, understandably. But many filmmakers then only start to fund for outreach once the film has been completed or once the production funds are in. Not always, but often that's the case. And so I really do agree that a line item for audience outreach or audience engagement is crucial, and it should be built in ideally from the beginning, just as the, you know, just in the same way that you would have a development budget and a production budget and a post-production budget. You should also then have an audience outreach and engagement budget as well. And then in terms of marketing promotion, yes, I do think that should be a separate line item. I think that audience engagement and outreach and marketing and promotion can overlap, and I think sometimes they lift each other up, so what supports one is going to support the other. But if they have separate line items, then you know you're being very proactive in budgeting and fundraising for each. And I think they are distinct. That's something that often is a point of confusion for filmmakers who have not, you know, run an outreach campaign before, is, you know, how does outreach differ from promotion? And the way I like to think about it is that, you know, outreach is about relationships. Outreach is really about cultivating relationships with your audience so that you can invite them to participate in your distribution and in your social action goals. Outreach is what you have to do to get the conversation started and to really understand the film and the film's topic from the audience's point of view. So that needs a robust budget. That takes a lot of time because it's about relationships, because it's about phone calls and meetings and lunches and a really thoughtful and authentic understanding of who your audience is and how they might help the film and how you might help them through the film. And because it's relationship-based, it therefore takes a lot of time. But those costs are primarily labor costs. They're the cost of hiring yourself as a filmmaker or a freelancer or a firm like ours to do that legwork and to pound the pavement in that way. And then promotion right. and marketing is more traditional. You know, promotion and marketing is tends to be have a slightly wider, it's on a wider spectrum. So that can include everything from traditional advertising to earned media and publicity to the kinds of, you know, co-promotional work that might happen when you have, let's say, a corporate partner or a nonprofit partner who is going to promote the distribution of the film alongside traditional advertising. So again, you know, the costs there tend to be a little bit more a little bit less about labor, although there is certainly still a lot of labor involved in marketing and promotion. But yes, it's a different thing, and there needs to be a budget for that as well.
Right. Well, tell us how people can reach you, and also we're very interested in how people can work with you, because I see on your website you've got a great outline on things that you cover in your consultations, and boy, do they need it. Every line item in that advertisement is sorely needed, from practicing your pitch to finding your audience to creating your goals. I would imagine that it would benefit filmmakers at early stages to contact you, talk about their film, and get some direction so that they're sort of on track with the information that you've shared with us today while they're making the film. They're identifying their audience and putting key players in place, not only for marketing but outreach too, right?
Absolutely, yes. We really encourage filmmakers to contact us early, at least for an initial conversation. One of my goals when I started Film Sprout was to be as accessible as possible to filmmakers, especially filmmakers working with smaller budgets or filmmakers who are still securing funding, because, of course, there is this chicken and egg problem in all industries, but in independent documentary filmmaking, specifically, where if you don't have the money, you end up not doing some of the work, but then if you don't do the work, you can't get the money. And so we wanted to create this kind of low bar to entry. So first of all, what I'll say is that, you know, we speak with close to 300 filmmakers each year in some capacity, either at film festivals or in a formal consultation or in an informal consultation. And that informal consultation is something that we offer free to any filmmaker who's contacting us for the first time. So we will do a 15-minute intensive session with any filmmaker who gives us a ring and wants to hear about the work we do and wants to tell us about their project. And that's often a good starting point so that we can explain how we work and why it might be helpful to work with us, and also so that we can have a sense of what a new project coming down the pike is like and what it's about and what the goals are. Many filmmakers start with that 15-minute session, and it galvanizes them. They then return to the grindstone. They do a little bit more homework. They get their ducks in a row, and then we can come back and work together in a more formal way, you know, in a formal consultation, where we really dig into the meat of things. And those consultations are often also intended to be as flexible as possible for filmmakers. So filmmakers don't have to commit to multiple hours with us. They don't have to commit to, putting us on retainer. They can pay by the hour. They can pay as they go. They can schedule consultations as they go and as needed, which for some filmmakers, particularly new filmmakers or filmmakers who are still fundraising, is really crucial. You don't want to sink your money all in one place, and we really respect that and understand that. So we are eager to hear from filmmakers who just want to learn more about us and what we're doing and want to tell us about their projects.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly let them know that, Caitlin. And what is your email and what is your website?
Yes, thanks for asking. We are at filmsprout.org, and the email address is right there at filmsprout.org. It's films with an S at filmsprout.org, and that will come to me or one of my colleagues, and we usually are able to respond within a day. We try to be really nimble about that because we know it's important to hear back from your prospective distributors. So we make it a point to get back in touch with people right away and to be as accessible as possible. So filmsprout.org, check us out. There's lots of information on the site as well, not only about how we work, but also about the campaigns that we've run. If you click on the Our Films section of the website, you'll see a couple dozen projects that we've worked on in some capacity or other in the past. And you'll see the range of work we do from, a single hour-long session with a filmmaker to plot their overarching strategy all the way to running an entire campaign for a year and everything in between, writing discussion materials, helping to write grant applications, helping to create pitches for funders, helping to shape a Kickstarter campaign. We can be helpful in a lot of areas and are eager to hear from filmmakers who need that kind of support.
Okay. Thank you so much, Caitlin, and best of luck to you and your crew.
Thank you so much for having me.
We look forward to talking.
Yes, it was really a pleasure.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Be well, everyone. Take good care.
Bye.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.